Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We feel the impact of laws and the law in one way or another every day. And during the last year, some major issues and rulings inspired robust discussion and even controversy. In some cases, there were major changes to the status quo, and in some, there were not. For today's Legal Roundtable discussion, we'll be talking about just that as we look back over the year just ending and try to peek ahead to the new year. Joining me in studio are attorneys Mark Smith, Associate Vice Chancellor at Washington University, and he directs the Career Center there. Bill Freivogel is Professor of Journalism at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. And back with us once again, Jared Boyd, President of the Mound City Bar Association. He is also Chief of Staff and Counsel for the St. Louis Treasurer's Office. And we'll be asking for your input. What legal issue impacted you most this year? The number 382-8255. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us. Nice to have you once again.
Good afternoon.
Jared, let's start with you. I'd like to ask each of you in turn what you think the biggest legal story of the past year is, nationally and locally.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me back. I think the biggest issue, both nationally and locally, has to do with police reform. There are several officer-involved shootings or deaths that have been in the news since the Michael Brown shooting. Almost too many to name: Tamir Rice in Cleveland, Mario Woods in San Francisco, Freddie Gray in Baltimore, and Laquan McDonald in Chicago. And we are dealing and grasping with the issue of police reform in the midst of an uptick in crime, both in St. Louis and other areas of the country that started before the killing of Michael Brown, kind of dispelling the notion of this Ferguson effect. So I think St. Louis and other parts of the country really have to struggle with the role of police in the midst of an uptick in violent crime. So I think it really has defined several of the legal issues, both locally and nationally.
All right. I'm sure we'll be talking more about that as the program proceeds. Bill Freivogel, your thoughts?
Well, I think nationally the biggest legal change or development was the same-sex marriage decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, this is one of those decisions that comes maybe every decade or something. I mean, think back to 2000. There weren't any states that had same-sex marriage. Congress had just passed the Defense of Marriage Act, and here we are 15 years later, and it's a constitutional right. I doubt if anybody foresaw it could happen that fast. And even though there were some developments afterwards of resistance and criticism, you know, by and large, that is sort of falling away. Even in the Republican presidential debates that I've heard, it's sometimes referred to sort of indirectly, but I haven't heard too much direct, straight-on criticism. So I think that's an amazing development.
We should point out that St. Louis, the city of St. Louis, was slightly ahead of the curve on that with regard to same-sex marriage.
Yeah, that's right. The city of St. Louis was. Yeah. And then I would agree with Jared that, I mean, I think the next most important national story and the most important local story is all the developments that since the killing of Michael Brown. Of course, that was a year and a half ago. But a year ago, I mean, we were just trying to recover from the grand jury's decision not to indict Darren Wilson. There were calls for grand jury reform, for a new grand jury. Then we had the two March Justice Department reports, one of them saying that Darren Wilson wouldn't be prosecuted, the other saying that Ferguson had this terrible record of unconstitutional, racially biased policing. President had a commission on policing. The Ferguson Commission issued its findings. There were subsequent Justice Department commission reports, after action reports on Ferguson. And I think there's been passage of Senate Bill 5, recently St. Louis County Council passing minimum standards for police. So I think there have been real reforms in terms of how the municipal court system works, in terms of needing more police training, more police training in community policing, de-escalation to try to avoid The kinds of situations that with Darren Wilson killing Michael Brown.
And it's still very current because the Justice Department and the city of Ferguson are negotiating at this moment with regard to the future of the police department and how it will function.
That's right. And there are a lot of, I mean, there are a lot of legal issues that are still out there. I mean, we just found how hard this is with the decision, inability of the jury to reach a verdict in Baltimore in the Freddie Gray case.
Yeah.
So these are not simple answers, but I think we're making some progress.
Right. I want to come back to that Freddie Gray case, given its currency. Let's go to Mark Smith now.
So I would agree with Bill on the gay marriage Supreme Court case. I mean, I think, like Bill said, that's a once every decade case. That'll be something that when you're a first year law student studying con law, you'll read an excerpt of that case, I think, 10 years from now, 20 years from now. Local, I would identify Senate Bill 5, the which Bill kind of mentioned, which because I think it's going to change the makeup of St. Louis County, and I think it's going to really it's putting in place, and there are going to be challenges to it.
Let me interrupt just so the listeners understand. Senate Bill 5 is the one that deals with fines and fees and municipal court reform,
and okay. says that they cannot make up more than I think it's. 12.5% in St. Louis County, 20% in the rest of Missouri, but 12.5% of your revenue. And so it's going to put real pressure on many of these municipalities and may drive them under. I would agree that the police is a big, I mean, it's a big national and local issue. One thing we haven't mentioned is the Civilian Review Board, which finally, you know, has come into, it's still not acting yet, but it's in place for the city of St. Louis. And that's been talked about for at least 20 years, as long as I can remember, and never
least,
seemed like
at least 40 years.
Really?
Yeah.
You got a longer memory, or maybe you're older. I don't know which.
Both.
All right. So while we're on this subject, I'm certain we'll come back to it. Let's talk about the Baltimore situation for a moment. This is a mistrial. What does that really mean in terms of where we go from here? Do we automatically assume there's going to be another trial? Will there be another trial?
I don't think we know the answers. I mean, there could be another trial. It occurred because the jury could not come to a verdict. I think the state had a fairly weak case here. The problem for the state for the prosecutors is that they seem to hope that they would get this conviction and then the defendant would be able to testify in all the others. Five or six prosecutions that would follow. Well, now the defendant can just take the Fifth Amendment because he would still face his criminal jeopardy. So it makes their whole effort to do these prosecutions more difficult.
Is that why Jared he was tried first? Because he's the weakest link in the chain in terms of responsibility for Freddie Gray's death. From what I understand, I mean, he did not put him in the van. He was not part of the van transport team. That he was not as directly involved as some of the other officers.
I think there was a strategic decision made by Marilyn Mosby, who's the prosecuting attorney in Baltimore, to try and induce this gentleman to testify against his former colleagues at the police department. And he, in this instance, instead of probably taking a plea agreement, chose to go forward to trial based upon the recommendations of his defense counsel. So what follows for the future and the future of the prosecutions is going to be interesting to see, because I'm not sure how the state is going to go forward with prosecuting the other people who were actually in the van and more responsible for Freddie Gray's death.
A lot of people are certainly grateful that the lid stayed on in Baltimore last night.
Yeah.
A lot of concern that there would be a repeat of what happened earlier on. Mark, any other thoughts about that?
No, I think, I mean, I assume if they chose not to prosecute him again, they could offer him immunity and then he would have to testify. I'm not sure if they're willing to do that. And also, you know, you still got this the blue wall of silence, and I mean that seems to be the biggest issue in these cases. But I agree with, you know, you're seeing many more of these cases than we would have seen 10 years ago. So it seems like something has changed, and it's not changed completely, but it's going in that direction. And this Oklahoma case, where the police officer was convicted, you know, for just these terrible actions, the police are being scrutinized and being subject to a much closer look and control, and you know, that doesn't mean everyone's doing bad things. It certainly doesn't mean that, but hopefully the ones who are will be found out, and it'll change some behavior.
And we haven't even mentioned Chicago, you know, with the case there where the officer has now been charged with murder. And there's that terrible video just showing him unloading his gun into the person who is sort of running at an angle, mostly away from him.
I mean, this is not a legal issue, but I do think like these dash cams and just private citizens with phones, that's been one of the big forces for change, because
it's changed everything.
Yes, yeah, because it's not like you can say, well, this is what happened, and somebody, you look at the picture, and when you look at that video from Chicago, it's incredible.
Yes, and it leads to people asking additional questions.
Right.
Chicago's paid over $500 million in legal fees and settlements since 2004 for excessive force cases. There's several elements in the union contracts that police have that are coming under scrutiny, which protect police from discipline. The gentleman involved in the Laquan McDonald shooting had over 18 complaints lodged against him. And so Campaign Zero and some other national organizations are starting to really scrutinize union protections for police officers that are disciplined.
And what about the notion of paying a $5 million settlement in Chicago before the video was even released? I mean, that in itself is an indictment, I think, a lot of people are suggesting.
Yeah, I think that was maybe the practice. And from what I read, I mean, I don't know this myself, but from what I read, it seems like that was the practice in Chicago, is when you had a really bad police, you know, shooting or police misconduct case, you try to pay them off, pay them a big settlement and get confidential, you know, make part of the deal, you don't disclose this or that.
Before we get too far away from Senate Bill 5, and I need to take a break, but Ron wants to join us from St. Louis on that issue. So let's take a quick call from Ron. Go ahead.
Yeah, I believe that whole bill is unconstitutional. It's not based on population. It's not based on traffic stop. And it exempts all the municipalities outside of St. Louis County and city in Kansas City. I'll give you an example. My brother got a ticket in Platte County. Well, he calls his attorney and asks him to handle a ticket. But the first thing the prosecutor tells him, he needs to contact a lawyer there and not one in St. Louis. By the time it was all over with, he spent $650 for a 80-mile-an-hour speeding ticket. So why should these other municipalities be exempt from something for St. Louis City and County?
Thanks, Ron. Anybody have a thought?
Well, I would agree. I personally agree with him that at least the portion of the law that that says that outstate can collect 20% of their revenue from traffic fines, but St. Louis County municipalities only 12.5%. I think that probably will be found unconstitutional. Yeah. I mean, you never can predict what courts are going to do, but it sure seems like there's a lot of different grounds on which to claim that that's unconstitutional. There are other really good parts, though, of Senate Bill 5 relating to the functioning of municipal courts and how some of these minor cases are handled and how to collect the fines as debts rather than sort of criminal matters. And so I think that those probably will withstand any kind of a challenge.
I want to pursue some of that in a moment, but we have to take that break. Let's do that now. This is our Legal Roundtable discussion, our monthly get-together. With me in studio is Bill Freivogel, from whom you just heard. Mark Smith is also with us. He is a regular. And joining us once again is Jared Boyd, president of the Mound City Bar Association. Back to continue the conversation. If you want to be a part of it, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org, and we'll take your tweet at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our Legal Roundtable panel discussion. We'll continue that conversation in a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Supporters of increasing the tax on cigarettes in Missouri by 23 cents a pack are collecting signatures to get the proposal on the ballot. Missouri currently has the nation's lowest cigarette tax at 17 cents a pack. The Jamal Learning Center, a charter school in North St. Louis, will close at the end of the current school year. Since it opened in 2011, the school has struggled both academically and financially. Its sponsor, the University of Missouri-Columbia, decided to let its charter lapse at the end of June. The Illinois budget impasse, now in its sixth month, will be at the center of discussions during another meeting between legislative leaders and Republican Governor Bruce Rauner this afternoon. The meeting would be the third in as many weeks as Rauner and lawmakers try to reach a deal to end that stalemate. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our legal roundtable panel, Bill Freivogel, Mark Smith, and Jared Boyd. You know, the St. Louis County is trying to standardize rules and regulations and procedures for departments in the county. Before we started, Mark, you said that you noted that Webster Groves has, just surprised you, has joined this group of police departments that are challenging that that county decision. Why were you surprised at Webster?
Well, I just, and I don't really know because I live in the city, but I just kind of assumed that Webster Groves seems like it's pretty well resourced and that they would have a pretty professional police force and wouldn't be concerned about. Now, you know, maybe they're saying, no, it's not about that. It's just we think the county is overstepping their bounds. Although I just don't get that argument. It seems to me that the county should be able to set minimum standards for police officers, and I don't really understand why that wouldn't be allowed. That it's we do that for lots of different things.
Jared, does this fall in line with your concerns about police reform, what the county is attempting to do?
I think what the county is attempting to do embodies some of the best practices that have been put forth in several of the reports that were done this year, Ferguson Commission, the police reform initiative coming out of the Obama administration. And I think the argument is going to be whether or not the county has inherent power under public safety.
Public health
to regulate police to this degree. Webster Groves did, I think, vote down some tax increases this year. So it Maybe. Is interesting to see an entity that's not in North County.
Right.
that's why you're
join
surprised.
This police suit.
Yeah, right.
Well, you know, Webster Groves did have a couple of officers about a decade ago who were got in trouble about being in a swimming pool with some young women.
Which
led to some actual, issues at the Department of Public Safety on whether they should lose their licenses and stuff. But that aside, I mean, I think that there's a legal question. I think these reforms that are in the St. Louis County passed bill for minimum police standards are really good. But I think it's a little bit of a stretch to say this is public health. I mean, maybe the courts will let them do that. It's fine with me if they do. But it seems a little more like public safety than public health. There's also the ironic thing that both the St. Louis County bill and Senate Bill 5 have, which are seen as reactions to Michael Brown, are having their biggest effect on small African-American communities in North St. Louis County, where some of the African-American young emerging politicians have positions.
Right, and we've talked about this before, but there's always a question, an issue, potential for bankrupting some of these cities, and would dilute some of the political power of African-American politicians.
And you see some of the African-American leaders saying, this was all fine while the white people were in charge. Now we're in charge, all of a sudden you've got a problem with it. I don't think it's like that, but I definitely can see their argument and see why they would not be happy about it.
And I think there are a lot of sticks with Senate Bill 5 and this policing reform initiative coming out of the county council that will probably propel a lot of these jurisdictions to consolidate services. But I don't know if they're necessarily any inducements for economic development that will help some of those areas when you reduce fines for traffic stops. And I think what you'll see is you'll see a reduction in fines for housing violations in the current session for the Missouri legislature. So you're foreclosing all of this revenue, but you're really doing nothing to offset that with economic development.
And better schools, I mean, which seem to be the kind of, poverty is the underlying issue, and those are probably the two most important things to change that.
There are a number of other things to talk about, but while we're here with the police and the whole police issue, a couple of quick calls, and then we'll move on. Tom in Glendale. Jared, you mentioned the legislature. I think Tom wants to get into that. So, Tom, thanks for waiting. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Don. I really applaud St. Louis Public Radio and St. Louis on the Air for your coverage this past year and a half of Ferguson and Black Lives Matter. There's no question that we have problems of racism and racial inequality in St. Louis and in America. But I think there are something that's getting lost is that a lot of people here are concerned about just the general level of police violence against everyone. And it's definitely disproportionate against Black people, but their police are just too violent in general. And so one of the things that I felt has gotten lost is this police use of force law question. And I'd like to ask the panel for an update on whether we can look forward maybe this year to a change, clarification, best practices with the state use of force law.
Tom, thank you.
Well, the last year the legislature did not change the Missouri use of force law. The Missouri use of force law is out of step with the Supreme Court standard. The Supreme Court standard is you an officer cannot use deadly force to stop a fleeing felon who is unarmed and non-dangerous. But that is permitted. A police officer in Missouri under Missouri's use of force law is permitted to use force to stop a fleeing felon. And so there were various proposals last year in the legislature to change that, to try to fix that. None of them got even close to passing, as I recall it. I don't know what the prospects are this year, but the legislature doesn't always give me a lot of hope.
Sure, and as Bill said, Missouri standard is unconstitutional. It is out of line with Tennessee versus Gardner, the case that the Supreme Court has on this issue. It's incredibly low-hanging fruit, and I think the legislature, both sides, understand that it's an unconstitutional issue that needs to be addressed.
Normally, it's an urban-rural divide that causes things like this. This is not necessarily the case, though, with this particular issue, or is it in the legislature? I mean, use of force law is use of force law, regardless of.
I mean, there were various proposals from legislators in our St. Louis County, North St. Louis County, to change it. But I mean, in some cases, those proposals, they weren't really clean fixes, and then the fixes from people in outstate didn't go far enough. So it was the inability to come together for just a simple clean fix. And this it has consequences because if Darren Wilson or a person in Darren Wilson's shoes had been charged criminally, he could have used this Missouri law to say, hey.
Right.
I had the right to shoot Michael Brown because he was a fleeing felon. He had just assaulted me in the police car. He's a fleeing felon. I had a right to shoot him under Missouri law, even if the U.S. constitutional standards would say that wasn't so.
Yeah. One more call in this general area, then we'll move on. Fred in Glendale. Oh, Glendale is with us today. Another Glendale call. Fred, go ahead.
Hi, Don.
Hi.
Hooray for Glendale.
Yeah.
Well, my question is this. In the case of these mistrials, is there any category of cases which bars prosecutors from retrying those cases?
No, it is not double jeopardy.
Yeah.
So the case can be retried.
Any case.
Any case like this where there's where a jury has not come to a verdict. So there hasn't been there isn't initial jeopardy, so you can retry it.
Do the charges have to be the same? Can they amend the charges somehow?
They can refile, and I think they can refile whatever they want.
That's right.
Okay.
Going back to this police, the issue, it was interesting, our first Glendale caller was talking about, the issue of police violence and maybe incivility to civilians, and I'm sure that happens from time to time. But I really think the solution to it may not be legislation, legislation with the cameras, because I mean that's And I think it needs to be sold to police officers as this will protect you too.
You mean the police the police body
whether
cams?
Whether it's dash cams or body cameras, because we all act better when we know people are watching us. And police officers take a lot of grief, and I think people see that. I mean, doesn't justify violence or anything, but to see that this was not the situation that the citizen was describing, or police officer when they act out of
it takes the he said she said out of out of the court.
It doesn't give you absolute because you never have the whole thing, but you got a much better picture than you did without it.
More training to how to get police can get along with citizens and how they can de-escalate a situation
and less maybe focus on tactics like a military type tactic and more of a social worker type, which is that I know that's controversial among police.
I'd like to move along because there's so many things for us to cover. It was a big year. I was a little surprised that none of you picked red light cameras as one of the top stories of the year, and I only say that because so many people are impacted by that and by basically tearing up that law. It saved a lot of people a lot of money and caused some municipalities some grief because they have to repay the fines that were adjusted. Thoughts about the red light camera deal?
Well, one reason I didn't think it was such a big deal is that the municipalities can put them right back in effect. The Missouri Supreme Court said, no, the way you've got this set up is not legal because you put too much burden of proof on the owner of the car. But you can set these up in a way that's consistent with state law, and you can have your red light cameras right back. So I think in the long run, probably a lot of cities are going to reimpose them.
Another issue that got a lot of traction this year is the Uber situation. That's been bouncing around in the courts. St. Louis seems to be well behind the curve with regard to accepting Uber, given the fact that it's all over the world and a multi-billion dollar proposition. Where is this going?
It's interesting because Uber has made the strategic decision to operate in St. Louis despite being in legal limbo, and you can get a Uber ride from the studio right now after the segment, despite the fact that they really don't have any kind of legal ability to be here per the MTC, the entity that regulates cabs. So I don't think this litigation is really going to get solved anytime soon, and it may become moot when the Missouri legislature either takes power away from the MTC or take some other role in regulating Uber directly.
But it's still being litigated, and Uber has the resources to do a good job with it. And they have this antitrust argument that I think is a pretty good one. So,
and it's going to bounce around for a while. There's no question about that. Okay. Couple of things I want to get to, but I want to be sure to get this in because it's so current, and that is recent comments from Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Look at my notes here. He says essentially that blacks do less well at good schools, as he put it. African-American students might fare better in a slower-track school rather than more competitive colleges. That's a justice from the United States Supreme Court speaking just a few days ago. Not one of the top stories necessarily of the last year, but certainly an interesting one. Your thoughts about a justice of the highest court making comments like this, Mark?
Yeah. So, first of all, I think this Fisher case could be the big
legal. This is the affirmative action case.
That out of Texas could be the big legal story of next year because I think there's a small chance, probably less than 20%, that they would say you can't consider race in college admissions anymore. I don't think that's going to happen, but I think what's going to happen is because there's been a lot of effort, and the people who are fighting on this case and other ones, they want more transparency as to how colleges are making decisions and how they're considering race. And colleges don't like to talk about it, and they talk about it being an art and everything. But as more data comes out, it's just going to give these people more ammunition to fight. Going back to what Scalia said, I mean, there's this mismatch theory that was put forth in, I think, a Stanford Law Review article about 10 years ago, and there's been another Stanford Law Review by different law professors saying, no, that's not true. But Scalia, he likes to be provocative, so he takes this, which is not stated the way he stated it, and then makes it much more headline.
He has First Amendment rights, too, as I understand
he's got, and he's got lifetime tenure, right? He can say whatever he wants.
Yeah, however, I mean, is it really proper for a Supreme Court justice to be making comments like this that directly reflect on a case that he's going to be considering?
I think he, in an inarticulate manner, tried to regurgitate the mismatch theory that Mark was talking about. Richard Sandard at UCLA Law School wrote this article that Mark was referring to, arguing that minority students actually are harmed by affirmative action because it leads them to schools that they are not qualified to attend, which leads them to worse outcomes, whether it's in the job market or whether it's actually performing in the school. Several social scientists, even a really good amicus brief in the Fisher case that dispels and takes issue with Richard Sanders' work that African Americans and other minorities are actually harmed, both on some of the statistical grounds that were cited in the Sander case, and then some of the outcomes saying that, for instance, African American students actually graduate at a higher rate at prestigious schools. To say that they would do better at less prestigious schools is simply incorrect based upon graduation numbers. So there are a whole host of other reasons that have been used to kind of dispel the mismatch theory. But in this instance, I think Scalia was in an inarticulate way trying to regurgitate this theory that has in many instances kind of been taken issue with.
So Justice Scalia has a right to say anything he wants in an oral argument. And, you know, that is not a place where taking a side – should lead to him being disqualified or anything. As everybody else said, this was very inarticulate the way he did it and offensive. He was trying, I think, to refer to this mismatch theory. Stuart Taylor is a former New York Times reporter who covered the Supreme Court when I did, and he's one of the people who has advocated this mismatch theory, but even he said that Scalia was so inarticulate he just made it almost impossible to defend the theory. One other thing to note is that half of the political and corporate leaders in the United States come from 12 universities. So, you know, if Justice Scalia wants to just bar African Americans from those 12 universities, you know, what kind of disadvantage are we talking about people being put in?
What about the Supreme Court? What's the university?
Harvard.
I think they get a Yale in there every once in a while. Yeah, just for diversity, right?
It's interesting. Judge Scalia once told a law student at American University, which is a good school, but not a typical feeder school, that she couldn't probably become a Supreme Court clerk because you can't turn a sow's ear into a silk purse.
What's offensive about that? Yeah,
I don't know.
Got to take another break.
But I think he likes that being offensive. I mean, he views it as provocative.
I still can't believe that he and Justice Ginsburg are buddies. Somehow it doesn't compute. Let's take that break. We'll come back, continue our legal roundtable discussion in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our Legal Roundtable panel discussion. With me in studio are attorneys Mark Smith, Bill Freivogel, and Jared Boyd. Gentlemen, we mentioned the Supreme Court's same-sex ruling this year, but we haven't talked much else aside from our just concluded conversation about Justice Scalia, about much else before the court this past year. Obamacare, back before the court, and fared okay once again. Right, Bill?
Yeah, it got through again. Even maybe might have been 6-3 instead of 5-4 this time, if memory serves. So this was the third round of Obamacare cases. You know, the first one back in 2012 was upholding the mandate that you had to buy insurance. And the second round went against Obamacare. It was the Hobby Lobby case where Hobby Lobby was able to say they had religious objections to the requirements under the contraceptive mandate. And then now this was the third round this past June where the court said that the subsidies provided under the law were available in states where the federal exchange was set up because the states wouldn't set up their own exchange. It had been argued that the subsidies should not be available in those states. And if the decision had gone the other way, it probably would have wrecked the law. Now we're getting ready for a fourth round on this again on this whole issue of the contraceptive mandate and the religious objections to it, and that will come before the court in March, I believe.
Right, it's not going away. The attempt session after session to kind of nibble at the edges of Obamacare.
The one court that has ruled that the current Obamacare rules on the contraceptive mandate are a violation of religious freedom is the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals here in St. Louis, which ruled in a case involving, I think it's called Sharp Holdings and Heartland Center. But there are about seven other cases where courts have ruled the opposite way and said the Obama law on the contraceptive mandate is constitutional. So we'll see what the Supreme Court says.
Right. Any other thoughts?
Yep. Linda Greenhouse at the New York Times wrote about this and mentioned that it's fascinating that the court is considering this issue 50 years after the landmark Griswold case, which provided married people the constitutional right to use contraception. So the fact that we're still talking about contraception in this day and age, the fact that women, by and large, use contraception that, whether they're Catholic or not, it's fascinating that it's still an issue that's litigated and still a hot topic 50 years later.
And another issue that's some 40 years later that will be back before the court this coming term is abortion, as it always is. Okay, any other thoughts with regard to the court this past year? Let's move on then to the issue of guns. Anywhere you turn anymore, it is an issue that is before us. I'm wondering if, given the recent spate of shootings that we've experienced, these horrible tragedies that have taken place, do they change? Have they changed? Will they change the gun debate at all?
I don't exactly think so, because I think if killing 20-plus first graders at Sandy Hook.
If Sandy Hook didn't do it,
nothing is going to do it. Of course, it did. For a little while after Sandy Hook, there was enough of a window that New York, where Cuomo acted very fast, did get a strong, law through. But that window closed really fast. And I think people are more, whether or not they should be, I think people are more worried about the terrorism end of the San Bernardino than they are about the gun availability end of it.
And the Heller case, which was we've talked about before, the gun case, which kind of recognizes Second Amendment personal right, has made it, I think, much more difficult for Congress to act and for states to act than in the past. And so, and people will use that as an excuse. But I think it has more to do with political will than it has to do with legal or constitutional limitations.
I would agree with Mark, but also point to a recent Supreme Court decision not to review a court of appeals case in which the Seventh Circuit upheld a local ordinance banning assault weapons. After Sandy Hook, a Chicago suburb actually passed an assault weapons ordinance ban, and that was upheld by the Court of Appeals that regulates Illinois. And the Supreme Court actually refused to review that rule and potentially overturn that ruling. So I would agree with Mark that, by and large, these issues come down to legislative will.
And I agree with that, too. I mean, I think the Second Amendment decision in Heller, the personal right to have a gun in your house to protect yourself, that is just cited as an excuse by people to not pass gun regulation. You can still have the regulation of assault weapons. You can still have the regulation of big magazines. You can still close the gun show loophole. You can still have concealed carry laws. The Supreme Court didn't say any of those things violated the Second Amendment. We have this sort of related issue in Missouri where you have Amendment 5 that talks about this unalienable right to have a gun. And to this point, at least, the Missouri Supreme Court has said yes, that was passed legally, and it's it provides a lot of protection for gun rights, but it really didn't change the law at all in Missouri.
I'm sorry to interrupt. But what I was just thinking of was the discussion now with regard to Amendment 5 concerning the right of convicted felons to carry.
Right. So that's a case that I think is still, we're waiting for the decision from the Missouri Supreme Court on whether or not a convicted felon who is non-dangerous, a non-violent convicted felon, whether the law that says he can't buy a gun is a violation of this Amendment 5. And, you know, I guess I shouldn't make predictions, but I'm just best guessing that given what the Missouri Supreme Court has said about how Amendment 5 really didn't change the situation in Missouri, that they're most likely to say that the nonviolent convicted felons still can't buy a gun. But we'll see.
We have a call referencing the Heller decision here. Let's bring in Jay calling from Normandy. Jay, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, if a new president comes in and a new court appointee happens on the Supreme Court, could not the very bad Heller decision be overturned? And I was happy that Connecticut, I believe, was able to pass some recent gun control legislation. So I think American people do support background checks and getting rid of the gun control loophole. Thank you.
Thanks, Jay.
I mean, the answer is yes. It could be reversed. It was a 5-4 decision. And so if one of the conservatives left and was replaced by a moderate or a liberal, it could be changed. My gut feeling is it would not be changed.
It might be limited.
More limited over time. I think, you know, the Citizens United decision, on the other hand, if it were the same kind of change in personnel on the court with a Democratic president, I think it would be reversed. That's the one that says that corporations can use unlimited money in support of political candidates.
Any other thoughts? While we're on the subject of guns, let's talk for a moment about gun courts in St. Louis. And there has been a call from the police chief and the prosecutor, that would be Sam Dotson and Jennifer Joyce. They would have liked to have seen gun courts dealing specifically with this issue. The judges turned that down. I wonder if you gentlemen think that a gun court is a good idea, would have any impact. Jared?
I'm not sure it would be a good deal in certain instances. I think the judges in the Circuit Court of St. Louis had an issue with separation of powers and not being able to use discretion in cases. So for instance, if you are somebody who doesn't have a conceal and carry permit and you're picked up on the street with a gun, you could be charged with a gun felony and made to pay a $30,000 cash bond, which means that either you have $30,000 in cash or you're going to sit in jail until you can either work out a plea agreement or rush to trial. So that places an undue burden on folks who may not have received a conceal and carry permit, but you know, if you don't have a felony or a prior, that isn't considered in a reduction of the $30,000 bond. It's just kind of a per se issuance because you have a gun in the city of St. Louis. So I think judges should be able to use discretion, and it's really hard to regulate the flow of guns in a place like Missouri and then crack down on people who live in neighborhoods where they think a gun is necessary. I think it's difficult for the prosecutors and police to deal with guns, but at the same time, discretion should be exercised when someone doesn't have a prior felony or doesn't have a gun crime involving a victim.
Any other thoughts, gentlemen?
No. I think that's good. Yeah.
There's a bit of a spat going on in conjunction with this sort of thing in the city, and that is the head of the public defender's office here, Mary Fox, is taking both Chief Dotson and Jennifer Joyce to task, saying that they are putting pressure on judges to impose higher bail in gun cases. And I suppose this is, if in fact they're doing that, this would be their way of kind of getting around the fact the gun court was not established.
I mean, this is, I think, the $30,000 bail that Jared was just talking about. And, you know, just the other side of the argument is if you're for gun control, I mean, who better to control the guns of than the people who are arrested committing a crime with a gun? And so, you know, no, I don't think we should have prevented the detention of these folks. But that would be an argument in favor of gun courts and in favor of substantial bonds for, you know, accused suspects who have had who were found with guns on them.
Anyone else have
I mean, you got to be sympathetic to Chief Dodson. I mean, you've got all these shootings happening and they seem to be just kind of popping up where one side shoots and the other side shoots. We had there was a shooting where they shot through a door on the Del Mar Loop, and it was and you think to yourself, what is happening here? So I'm sympathetic, but yeah, we've got and
we've got a problem.
And I think they're trying to get a message out. Don't carry. I don't know that anyone's listening.
And I think there could be some positive elements of a gun court. Place for diversion of younger,
they could do something like that.
Younger perpetrators who carry guns but don't have victims, you know, providing them and connecting them to services for jobs and education, I think, could be a positive component of a gun court.
Right.
We only have a couple of minutes left, and a subject that is worth certainly a full program in and of itself concerns the question of national security and personal freedoms in this country. Well, I know it's an issue that you're particularly interested in, the tension between the two, as you have described it. Where is that right now, do you think? Where is it leading?
Well, if you listen to the Republican debate the other day, Cruz and Rubio pretty much teed this right up, Cruz had voted for the law that got rid of the government's bulk collection of metadata of all Americans' phone calls, and Rubio was accusing Cruz in supporting that of hurting national security. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, this is all this sort of Snowden revelations that there was this bulk data collection going on. And I think there was a lot of sympathy, a lot of feeling by a lot of Americans that this was affecting their privacy when this data, even though it's not the conversations, but when this data of who was called and what cell phone tower it went through was being collected by the government. And the Congress reacted by passing a law that said the government wouldn't collect it anymore. It's going to be the telephone companies that collect it. And so it's a real tough one. And given how frightened Americans are after the California attack, I think actually maybe for Americans to be as afraid as after 9/11 is overdoing it. But given where public sentiment is, I think that it's a lot harder to argue against the government trying to look for patterns among telephone calls to possible terrorists.
You agree with that, Mark?
I think it's harder to but I'm interested. So, do you think that's okay or not? I mean, I think I'm okay with it.
I'm okay with it too, actually.
Oh, really? I thought you would be against it. Okay.
No, I mean, I think as long as you aren't listening to the conversation, if you're looking for patterns, you don't have the names. I don't think people have a privacy right. in the metadata.
It's all about your expectation of privacy, I think, and I think the idea that the cell phones and computers. We don't have the same expectation of privacy we had before, I think.
Sure. I think Amazon probably knows more about me and my family
than
the federal government.
And Google.
Right. But I also think that regulation is always a step behind technology.
Right.
So a lot of the issues that we're talking about may not solve the next terrorist attack because, you know, terrorists can talk through video games or through other systems that will be regulated after another terrorist event will occur. But I do agree with Mark in the sense of our expectation of privacy, I think, really has changed. One, because the government tactics don't feel invasive. And two, I think we just have evolving expectations of privacy with regard to the way we share information on Facebook or with companies that collect data that make this an interesting issue because people don't really seem to be passionate about it.
Yeah, you kind of acquiesce.
Even after Snowden.
I mean, like you said, with Amazon, when they start popping up all the shoe ads, I just say, well, okay. I don't say I'm going to cancel them.
Right. We only have a minute left, and I'll go quickly through this. What headline do you expect to see in the legal world next
year?
Well,
what I would like it to be is all about this Fisher case, but what it'll probably be is some celebrity who gets arrested, and all of a sudden we'll have more print about entrapment or something like that, you know.
Fisher, again, being the affirmative action case before the Supreme Court. Bill, what headline would you anticipate?
Well, I think the Supreme Court will probably throw out the Texas abortion law that has led from there being 40 abortion clinics to more like about 10 in Texas as an undue burden on women seeking an abortion.
And very quickly, Jared?
Hopefully peace on earth. I'm not sure. I would like to hear more about the ability to reduce incarceration and how to really get smart on crime as opposed to tough on crime.
Thank you very much, Jared Boyd. Thank you for being with us, Bill Freivogel, Mark Smith. Thank you. That's it for today. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll talk with soprano Christine Brewer about her part in the Bach Society's Christmas Candlelight Concert. He'll have other guests as well. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with historian Bob Bussell about two prominent St. Louis labor leaders in the 1950s and 60s, Harold Gibbons and Ernest Callaway, and their influence in and out of the workplace. Archive versions of this program available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. Our thanks to Mary Edwards, Alex Hoyer, and Kelly Moffitt, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr and Spencer Reed. Executive producers Robert Peterson, thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.